Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. And today I want to have a deep dive conversation with somebody who is on the cutting edge of a topic that definitely needs to be discussed and taking an angle on this topic that up to now, as far as I'm concerned, has pretty much been non-existent. His name is Dr. Desmond U. Patton. He is a social worker first and a public interest technologist. And I don't think the titles really do justice to the work that he's doing. He's looking at social media. He's looking at gang violence. He's correlating the type of activities that take place online. And he's looking deeper into the reasons behind certain types of behavior of Black and brown youth. And so we're going to have a conversation about that. And Desmond, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
As we're talking, I would imagine there's a whole lot of people that want to get a hold of you because what we are bombarded with in this holiday season are images. And I don't even know if we can conclude that they're all Black and brown images. We've seen a few, you know, and we're assuming, but we're seeing hordes of people running into stores and, you know, Louis Vuitton and Nordstrom's and ransacking them, and people are wagging fingers, and all of a sudden they found money for police and they want to craft new laws and all this stuff. And at the end of the day, Black men, Black boys, brown men, brown boys, but Black men in particular became the boogeyman for all this sort of stuff. Police are running around and saying this is why we shouldn't defund, and you know, and even progressive folks are sitting up there standing in front of the Louis Vuitton store saying lock them up. The questions that I've seen you in interviews and talks bring to the table have not been raised. We just had the far gone conclusion that these are animalistic actions, these are animals that are perpetuating this type of crime. Even as they're saying, and I don't mean to be long-winded, but I'll conclude with this. Even as they're saying these are organized crime situations, and just somebody who has been to court like you, when you talk about organized crime, there's usually some very powerful people in the background that don't do the grunt work. This is the grunt work we're seeing. So we're not seeing their pictures, you know, being put up on TV, but we have Ray Ray from down the street, who is public enemy number one. So with that being said, you were doing this work way before these incidents came up. So let's talk a little bit about it. You know, what have you been doing and what have you been finding?
Yeah, so I came to this work as a gun violence researcher. I started my career in Chicago as a graduate student at the University of Chicago, trying to understand how high achieving Black boys were navigating what was considered the most violent neighborhood in Chicago. And in those conversations and with hanging out with those young boys and men, I understood the role of social media as a major contributor for how they were navigating safety, how they would identify safe locations, how they would communicate with each other. But something that came out of that connection that I think is oftentimes not discussed is that usually social media was used as a promotive and helpful tool for navigating daily life, that there's a lot of positivity that young Black boys and men are engaged in on social media, connecting with each other, sharing brilliant ideas, promoting businesses, loving on families, developing neighborhoods, you know, moving us firmly into the 21st century. But yet, in this emerging technology world, our focus is on what would be probably a very small percentage of negative behavior. And yet that lens, that gaze, is never turned on other people. One of the examples that I raise oftentimes in my work is that a few years ago, about 103, 104 Black boys and men were arrested in a conspiracy just north of Columbia University, where I teach, because they were followed on social media for months, sometimes a year, and their connections and affiliations and Facebook images was used to arrest them on charges of conspiracy. And then conversely, you have white mass murderers who have left racist manifestos on various social media platforms, and yet they were only reviewed post hoc. So they killed, and then we found their racist manifestos that basically told us what they were going to do in the future. And so that gaze, that look into the lives of people is not something that we've done equitably, and we have not turned that gaze onto other individuals, and particularly white individuals. And so the work has been quite challenging in that regard, because on one end, I'm committed to reducing violence in the communities that I'm a part of, but I also want to have a conversation about the surveillance of those communities that I'm also a part of, and how technology is going to be a part of that challenge as well.
Let's focus in on the surveillance. I would assume, because of your work, you've been in court to maybe share this. Okay. I have in the past as well. And not for necessarily the same things, but what has been a common thread is being in court and seeing that police, as you pointed out, have these huge dossiers. You know, we followed Ray Ray for the past 3 years, and they're doing all these connected dots, right? And then they have some very surface, very oftentimes very inaccurate conclusions. So, you know, Ray Ray said, man, I'm gonna kill you next time I see you. You know, you don't have the intonation, you don't have the context in which you said, but then you're sitting up on the stand saying, Ray Ray's a killer. Said he's gonna kill you the next time you see you.
Right.
And, you know, just to be anecdotical, then you come back and say, but Ray Ray is talking to his friend that he plays with Call of Duty. Next time I see, you know, but let's talk about that, because you really say the question is you don't want to talk about or be asked why people are violent without really looking at, for lack of a better word, the humanity behind it and the larger social construct. But it seems like this is a cottage industry to really look at our behavior as Black men, Black people online, and come to these foregone conclusions, while simultaneously these platforms may edit or throttle a conversation that me and you have that's political in nature, you know, that may have racial overtones about how we want to fight oppression. But somebody can show up with a gun and his post or her post will go viral, and there's no, you know, there's no intervention on their part until it's quote unquote too late, and it's fodder for surveillance.
Absolutely. This is one of the biggest concerns in my own work, because I have learned through my own mistakes in this space, the challenges with interpretation. And I think I want to kind of back up a little bit, because I think one of the things that happens is that we get locked into frames and narratives about Black people, Black boys and Black men in particular. And those frames can be imbibed and can fuel the types of questions that we ask with social media data. And that happened to me. And it was really a really embarrassing moment for me, but I have to be true. I was reading about Black boys and Black men in my studies and the media, and the framing was always negative, purely negative. And then the kind of research questions that I wanted to ask were a reflection of that negativity. It didn't even occur to me that I should be asking different questions of the data, because when your professor or when the New York Times or LA Times tells you that this is what you should be thinking, that's typically how we move in academic settings. And so it really took embedding myself in communities in a different way and being honest about my own biases as a Black man to really kind of put those issues on the table and to constantly be in a reflexive space around it. And so taking that into consideration, we have created a set of methodologies that force us to reckon with our bias. And so with any approach, we do a lot of labeling of social media data, and we have a 7-step procedure to force us to reckon with context and nuance. One, and then we also hire community members to be research assistants in the lab that push back against our interpretations, that help us to understand backstories and imagery and other things that we would just miss because we're not from that neighborhood. And one of my studies, one of the things I learned is that even when you put folks in the same neighborhood to look at a social media post from an individual from that neighborhood, they're going to have different opinions on how to interpret that post as well, because some of it is so hyper local in nature. So none of this is really happening within the police department. So there isn't some rigorous annotation or rigorous labeling process, and that information is being fed to a judge or to a jury who now is taking a social media post at face value without any type of context. This is the scariest part about this work.
You said there were seven things that you put as guidelines to kind of have you do these deep dives. Can you kind of maybe explain a couple that force you to really look at things differently or frame things differently?
100%. So first, we look at the biographical information that a user posts on social media. So in that window where you're talking about your name and where you're from, lots of content can be there. So for example, we see lots of young people memorializing someone that has been murdered, someone from their family that they care about. And that is a really important fact in how we then can interpret the posts, the text and images that we see. We look at the user's network, right? Because there's lots of performance that happens on social media. So someone may proclaim to be involved in certain activities, but then you look at who they're following and it's not the same life. It's a different situation in terms of who they're actually following. So there's some discontinuity there.
Let's build on that for 1 second. I still want to get the other ones because I think that's a key aspect, performance. We are now in a society where it's all about performance. Performance is rewarded. You know, mm-hmm. the algorithms will make your stuff go viral. So if we come on and we go, we have Dr. Desmond Patton and he's at Columbia, we're asleep, the post doesn't go viral. If we go, we have Davey D, the journalist, nothing happens. If we have Davey D and Dr. Patton arguing, right, and calling each other names, it is viral. It's everywhere. It's 100%. In everybody's feed, you know, Columbia versus, you know, Cal Berkeley, you know, that whole thing. And so, you know, my opinion on this is that we may play to the camera even if we don't realize it. And we might be grown men doing this with degrees. What happens to somebody who's 14, 15, or my daughter who's 11? They don't have all that.
And we now know that these tech companies are optimizing for the most negative behavior, the worst parts of ourselves. And so that argument is exactly what they want to share to your network and outside of your network to keep you coming back to the platform. So there's this work within the algorithmic code that is happening to keep us in this negative space where we can't grow, we can't learn. And it's also leading to challenges and violent behavior as well. So it's not just what we're doing, it's what is being optimized on the back end as well.
From the work that you're doing, do you find that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that if I get rewarded for a certain type of action, I all of a sudden feel compelled to do it or get sucked into it? I don't know if I'm framing the question right, but I think
I think it can be, but I think the importance here is that when you can help a young person unlock what is actually happening on these platforms and provide some critical reflexive education, some digital literacy, then there is space to intervene and to disrupt that as well. When I run a lot of different tech programs with young people, and when we bring them into these platforms and train them in how we code and look at data, that light bulb turns on. It's like, I didn't know that this was happening. I didn't understand that my words and my images could be interpreted this way. So yes, it can be self-fulfilling, but I want to leave us with some hope. I think that with education, and not education that says that you shouldn't be on the platform, but education about what's happening to you, what you're experiencing on these platforms can be one intervention to get us to the other side.
When we were looking at some of the things that are rewarded, some of the things that go viral, you had mentioned about bad behavior. Is that limited to, or maybe accentuated around Black people, Black men, Black boys? You know, in other words, we become the fodder. We become the entertainment for everybody. Everybody else, we're going to do the intervention. And let me just kind of give a context to this. There's an excellent show, and they've done maybe three different versions of it. It started off with a TV show called Merchants of Cool, I like, and all these things that really talked about behavior and media consumption and how it was affecting people. And I think there were recent things that they showed even on Netflix. But I didn't necessarily see somebody with your expertise be centered. I didn't necessarily see Black folks as being like, let's see how Sally reacts to this versus how Johnny reacts to this because of environment. And so, you know, when I was asking this question about, do we become this entertainment fodder? Like, it's almost like we'll intervene with everybody else. We'll give them digital media tools everywhere else, but we need to keep the mayhem and I'll call it safari-like behavior for this group of people, because this is where we're making our money. Black mythology and Black death cells, you know?
Yeah, you know, I think as a country, we have long been fascinated with Black culture in very negative ways that continuously perpetuate these pathologizing narratives about who we are. And we definitely see this play out in terms of how the Black experience is treated on social media. I've long been concerned around, like, why are we leaving up fight videos, right? Yeah. What what's the point? What's the purpose? Who's reacting? Who's labeling this as harmful or not? And oftentimes these types of critical reflexive questions are just not a part of the process. And when I'm oftentimes in these spaces having these discussions, I'm usually the only Black person, one of a very few people of color in the room, and definitely no one with a social work or mental health or community-centered background. And I think that this is a critical issue that we really need to be disrupting.
We were talking about the guide, so we stopped at performance. What were the other guidelines that you look at?
Yeah, we also look at the virality of a post. And so who's engaging with that post and how often and how many times a post is retweeted. And then we also ask our annotators, these are the folks that are labeling data, to look for outside resources to contextualize what they're seeing as well. So to make sure that they are talking to community members, that they are embedded in spaces that can help them make sense of the post with as much accuracy as possible.
What is the data showing from, you know, because we often say, what is the data? So thank God you're here because you have the data. So what are the tools that we need to have from you to help navigate this or understand it?
I would say my most important finding was two things. One is that expressions of grief, loss, and trauma oftentimes precede aggressive and threatening comments. And so what we would see is that young Black children were using social media as a promotive space, as a help-seeking space, not as a violent space. But when their grief was misunderstood, when their grief was disrespected, when their grief was made fun of, then within a two-day window, we saw them beginning to post in a more aggressive and a more threatening way. But none of this was ever attended to. None of this was ever understood in this particular context. And it kind of left, you know, space and opportunity to think about, number one, is that Black folks are not inherently violent, let's be clear. Number two, folks are actually reaching out for help and no one's understanding that that behavior could be thought of as being help seeking. And number three, that there's a missed opportunity for folks to actually support the very thing that folks are asking for. I'm going through a really hard time. I'm looking for help. And then we just ignore it or we disrespect it. And so I think that there's a lot of opportunity to think about how do we help people get resources? How do we help connect people to different opportunities? So that's what they're looking for on social media. And I think this focus on violence and aggression is actually a result of complex trauma, complex grief that has been untreated or misunderstood. So I think we've been focused on the wrong things. And if we actually want to reduce violence within a digital context, then I think focusing on the reasons why folks are on social media in the first place is a better place to start.
What are the young people that you have doing this work with you say? You know, how do they react to some of the things that you're doing? And you know, what do they have techniques on how people can intervene, and, you know, or do they intervene themselves?
We've learned so much from young people. And one of the things that we've learned from them is how they use humor and comedy as an intervention for de-escalating conflict online, right? So they are, Black folks generally are masterminds at using comedy and joy as a way for healing and liberation. And young people understand that very well. So they'll use memes and emojis and songs and just general jokes as a way of calming down a situation that could be over something very little. I think what we've learned is that especially over the last 2 years, we're all pretty sensitive. There's lots of things happening in our world. And so the things that we probably would have, you know, processed a little bit longer, maybe 5 years ago, we're reacting too much quicker. But the use of these really funny memes, or to take racist behavior to flip it as a way to induce humor, to make fun of someone that's trying to be racist, has been a great intervention that young people know all too well around how to do. But yet they're not being paid for that work, and they're not being honored for that work. They're not being recognized for their work. And so I think there's a missed opportunity again to recognize this brilliance within this digital context as well.
You run Safe Labs. That's your operation.
Absolutely.
In a world where we see trillion-dollar companies that are, or, you know, that are being honored, the Facebooks and what have you of the world, and we see, you know, we're near Silicon Valley, so every day there's a new startup.
Yeah.
How's that industry looking at Desmond Patton, Safe Labs, and the work that you're doing? Are people saying, this is a tool, this is an individual, this is an operation that we can use to, quote unquote, prevent cyberbullying? This is a tool that we can use to hone back potential violence. Are they embracing you, uplifting, and then giving you the resources that you need, or is the community, you know, finding out enough about you? So if they want to, how can they help, you know, scale this up? Because I think many people are looking and saying, if this is a ground floor problem, we need to be in your corner and pushing the work as much as we can.
To a point, in terms of tech companies, you know, I have been really blessed to work with some really amazing individuals at a lot of the top tech companies that see the value of the work, that are interested in the work, and have put forth some resources to supporting the work. But the challenge always comes as we move up the ladder, the bottom line business interests do not map on to the work, especially when I have been trying to call people in to say, I would love to see, you know, Meta and Microsoft and Twitter, like, take a, you know, a sizable portion of those earnings and put towards digital literacy and education and opportunities, particularly for young people of color, right? And allow and identify community members that can work in those spaces and help to run those spaces as well. So I think there's an opportunity there, but I have been supported by a lot of great people within those companies as well. I've had lots of great conversations with community members. They get really excited about this work. It's interesting because I don't have to like sell it, because they get it. They live it day to day. They just want their young people to be safe. they want opportunities. But I want to increase that, right? And so I'm in a space with my lab where we're trying to reimagine, you know, the Safe Lab 2.0, where we have stronger and true partnerships with communities that isn't just about research. It's also about creating the new cadre of scholars and practitioners that can do this work in their own communities. Because a lot of this is hyper-local. So you need people who have those sensibilities to be doing this work as well.
We started off, Desmond, Dr. Patton, by talking about surveillance. And, you know, I would imagine, I know I conclude, and I don't know if you do, that there's an abuse that comes on, especially when law enforcement starts looking and, you know, living online and coming to these foregone conclusions. Are those entities looking at your work and saying, well, you know, let's be more efficient? So, example, if we have this intervention, you know, you have an understanding of intervention. If you have police that are looking online and following these things, are they able to go, well, thanks to Dr. Patton's work, thanks to Safe Lab's work, you know, Ray is grieving. Let us intervene on that before this gets out of hand, right? Because police are supposed to be stopping crime in theory, or are they just letting it go and then coming down, you know, a year later and then, you know, just not only going after that person, but then everybody that that person communicated with and drawing these conclusions versus intervening, you know, before anything jumped off? Are they looking at the tools, the DAs, public defenders, police departments, et cetera?
It's interesting. So in our lab, we have a practice of not collaborating with police, and we don't share any data that we are working with. Recently, the conversation has been changing, I think, in more positive ways. Now, it's interesting that one of the first conversations that I've had about grief was with a police officer in Canada who understood that this grieving process was an important aspect of understanding a behavior and was interested not in the threats and aggression, but was interested in how do we understand grief. And I was like, oh, well, that's different, because that's never the conversation that I'm having with police officers within the US context. But they're also, you know, I've had conversations with different probation units across the country that are also very interested in really trying to get to the root causes of behavior in a way that's outside of, you know, a punitive and negative lens. So it is, but this is only within the last, I would say last 6 months that these conversations have really started to materialize. And I think I definitely would suggest that, you know, Black Lives Matter movements and young people and, you know, the pushback that our community is engaging in has been a part of hopefully changing hearts and minds in this space. So we definitely owe that to them. And I think that I want to be able to push that a bit more. So I am hopeful, but the general space has been to just not engage, because I haven't trusted that they will use the work, use the tools in a way that's actually going to be helpful for our community.
You know, last couple of questions before we let you go. One, you know, there are a lot of parents that are listening right now. You know, their kids are on social media. Mine's sitting right here.
Yeah.
You know, Dr. Patton, what should I look for? You know, what can I do? How do I engage? Give me some tools that I can know what my kids are doing when they're online, or at least recognize some of the signs that may say I need to jump in and jump in quickly and do something.
I think, you know, I really think it's important for parents to be having conversations with their young people about their social media life. I'm not someone that thinks that, I think that every parent needs to make a decision around their, like, their engagement with their child's social media. So that's a, that, I think it's a parent-to-parent decision. But I think at the end of the day, everyone should be asking questions about what their child is looking at, who they're talking to, what they're learning, what they're experiencing, and listen for, you know, conversations that are emblematic of experiencing pain and trauma or hurt. What we've learned is that a lot of young people have just develop lots of negative behaviors because of what they're watching on Instagram, what they're observing on Instagram. Do you know what your child is looking at on Instagram? Do you know how that's affecting their body image and how they think about their hair and their skin complexion and who their friends are? And so I really think that parents need to start those conversations. But I also think an important thing that parents should understand is that social media is the new neighborhood. Social media is not this virtual thing anymore that kids do on the side. You should be thinking about the same way you think about the block you live on right now. You should exactly be thinking about Twitter and Instagram and TikTok and Snap in the exact same way. So we have to understand that technology is here to stay. It's just going to get more advanced, and you have to be embedded in that neighborhood too.
You said, you know, that there are some very positive things that these social platforms have done. You know, we've been talking about the problems and that, but there's also some real, you know, great things that have been emerging. Can you share some of that?
Our greatest social movements of our time have been materialized and orchestrated on social media. Black Lives Matter. So the Me Too movement, all of these things have been, you know, channeled through a post that then connected to another post, that connected a community to another community. Our young people are very much understanding of that behavior and can also engage in that space as well. I think about the work of Sarah Jackson at a University of Pennsylvania that talks a lot about the power of these social movements for social change and transformation. And so there's a lot of positivity that's happening there that I think we can help young people think about advocacy in this space as a way of supporting new businesses, of developing new ideas, of advancing science. All these things are happening. We have to encourage it and support it as well.
Real talk. As we close, my last question, what do you see on the horizon? A lot of things at stake in 2022. Elections are coming up. There's a big fight around history being taught in classrooms, critical race theory. We're seeing a rise in suicides among Black kids, 80% increase. We also are seeing that as laws and restrictions are being hammered in, social media, as you pointed out accurately, becomes the new neighborhood. So with that backdrop, how do you see things unfolding? And, you know, and how do we get a hold of you for help?
Yeah, we really need to be concerned about myths and disinformation online. And it's not just about COVID. COVID is a critical piece. There's a lot of misinformation that's being spread to Black communities about who they are, about health, about mental health, about democracy. So we really need to have folks who are from the community being able to validate and to check these ideas. You should definitely be in the know of Matale and Conde and her communications group, AI for the People, who are really trying to democratize access to information.
Can you repeat that name again?
Yes, Matale and Conde. She is doing great uplifting work in this space, but we have to make sure that we're getting the most accurate information possible for our lives, for our health. I think that we should also be thinking about this idea of the metaverse, right? That this idea that our world is becoming virtual. And what does the metaverse mean for Black folks? How might a virtual world impact the lives of Black folks, right? So this is a new idea that's coming out of Facebook and Microsoft, but I'm not seeing a lot of Black folks wrapping their minds around what this means for our communities in the future. So we got to get ahead and be lockstep with these new conversations. So I'm hoping that we continue to move forward in that space.
Dr. Desmond U. Patton, thank you for joining us. How do we get a hold of you?
You can reach me on Twitter at Dr. Desmond Patton. And then if you Google SafeLab, all of my papers and presentations are there as well. So happy to stay connected.
There you have it. We appreciate you taking time out this afternoon. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We will be right back.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation, simulation. Step into the zone, the Bay Area zone.